Good morning, friends. Welcome to the roundtable. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. It is the 1st of June, a new month, and hopefully that will bring some new energy and some new power to what we've been living through over the past several weeks and months. We can only hope we get a bit of a clean slate here. But we welcome you to our conversation. We have a lot to talk about. It was a tumultuous weekend, a very harrowing weekend, and we have a lot to talk about. So we will do so. We welcome you into the conversation as we always do. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Let me introduce everybody, and we will get started on this conversation, in this conversation. Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, my friend. I'm okay. This whole thing is very disturbing. I'm very worried about all those people whose businesses have been broken into and hurt. And, of course, I'm in great sympathy with people who protest the systematic racism in this country.
It really is a lot to unpack and a lot to look at, and we'll do our best this morning. But absolutely, it was hard to get too far away from a news source this weekend and in keeping track of what was happening around the country. Joining us this morning, we welcome assistant professor at the is CG with us? Is CG on yet? Okay, we're looking to get CG on. I thought I heard her, but I guess I didn't. Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the University, American University, Cairo, Jim Ketterer is with us. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Nice to hear your voice, Joe, and everybody else.
Nice to hear yours. Thank you very much for being with us. It's good to have you here. Libby Post, it's been a while. I thank you for being here. Political consultant, good morning, Libby. How are you? Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey,
I'm
there
fine.
You are.
It's good to hear your voice, too. I will say that both Libby and Jim were scheduled to be with us on Friday, and we asked them if they would move because we wanted some other panelists on to talk about what was happening in Minneapolis as we started this conversation on Friday, and we're delighted that you're here this morning and can help us as we continue in the conversation. C.G. Dodds is expected to be with us. She is an assistant professor at Albany Law School. She was also with us on Friday, and we are just trying to get a hold of her. So she is calling in and normally is very good about such things, but I know everyone has been very, very busy this weekend talking to all kinds of folks about what has been going on. So we will keep you up to date on that one. In the meantime, let us begin. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. It was a weekend of protests. Another night of fire and fury as protests rage across this country. It was over the death of yet another black man in police custody. That led to another night of fire and fury. Protests that began peacefully exploded into mayhem as windows were smashed, stores were looted, buildings were vandalized, and police vehicles were torched. The unrest spread from Chicago, Atlanta, and Sacramento to Boston, Birmingham, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Of course, we would be remiss to say that I think all both Jim and Libby, being Albany residents, certainly know that this city was a part of that violence as well on Saturday. And so we will talk about that as well. We are broadcasting from a studio that was not harmed, but the store to the, if you're facing the building, the storefront to the immediate right and storefronts down to the left of us and across the street were greatly damaged and during the confrontations that took place on Saturday night. In some cities, officers in riot gear continue to increase their use of force, which added to the disorder. In Louisville, one man was shot and killed when city police and the National Guard opened fire following a confrontation between a group gathered in a parking lot and authorities attempting to disperse the crowd. Officials say that There were other developments as well. More than 4,000 people were arrested in U.S. cities over the weekend, according to the Associated Press. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio's daughter was among the hundreds of people arrested in the city Saturday after failing to disperse. Law enforcement sources also say the Minneapolis police chief said three officers who stood by while their fellow officer held his knee on George Floyd's neck share responsibility for the death that triggered the protests. Quote, I see that as being complicit, according to the chief. So there we are. That is what we have. And we welcome you again, panel at WAMC.org. Alan, let us begin with you.
Well, there's nothing that I have to say that I haven't said before, but let me do just that. Look, these protests are absolutely necessary in this country. We need to protest the systematic racism that exists, and we all know it. Nevertheless, there are always some people who, for their own reasons, will extend what is a peaceful protest, a meaningful protest, into something that is violent. And I have real issues with that, to be honest with you. I don't see how somebody walking out with a television set is a meaningful protest. What it's going to do, in my mind, I've said it before, I'll say it again, is to reelect or to help reelect Donald Trump as president of the United States, who will come on as a law and order guy and who will say that they're all the same, which they are not. And so if I'm the Tay Market down the street from WAMC, I love that store, run by people from of Korean descent who are doing a magnificent job in our neighborhood. And I shop there all the time. And now they have to contend with the fact that their place has been broken into, that the glass has been broken and the rest of it. I don't like it one bit. And I think if you think about it for a second, it doesn't speak well of some of the people who are doing this now. What we're finding, and we found it, Ray Graff just read it, is somebody got arrested from where? From Albany? No, from Delmar. To me, this is has to be unpacked, as in there are some people who are being very self-serving and irresponsible here in terms of breaking up what is a terrific and long overdue protest over systematic racism in the United States.
Libby. Libby Post.
Yeah, I'm here.
Are you at a loss for words? I don't know that I've ever done that to you. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's heartbreaking, all of it. And it's a very sad, sad day. And I lay all of this at the feet of Donald Trump. And I know that that's incredibly easy to say, but the fact of the matter is we have a coward in the White House who can't find it within himself to be able to rise above his own pettiness and self-centeredness and paranoia and narcissism to do what's best for the country. You know, vicious dogs and I can't remember what else he talked about. The weapons. I can't remember what the adjective was.
Thugs.
Yeah,
yes.
Thugs. You know, looting starts, shooting starts. I mean, the man is an out and out racist. He doesn't care what happens on the streets of this country, as long as Alan put it, he gets reelected. I'm not so sure that that's going to happen. But I really do lay this at his feet, along with the other turmoil that's going on in this country in terms of coronavirus. When you put these two things together, where COVID-19 and everybody's had to stay inside, and then you have this George Floyd murder at the hands of police, of course it's a tinderbox. And it's all, as far as I'm concerned, yes, there's systemic racism, there's institutionalized racism. This country was born on slavery. There's no two ways about that. I'm not dismissing that at all. But the what we're living through right now is a result of his presidency.
You know, you just referred, Libby, to the president's paranoia. I wonder if you'd explore that a little bit longer. How do you see that? I mean, how do you see his paranoia?
Well, anytime anyone says anything bad about him or criticizes him at all, he has to lash out. He's constantly looking over his shoulder. You know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean we're not out to get you. I mean, I get that, you know, because we are. But, you know, the man is paranoid narcissist. What's, you know, that's a great combination of somebody who's constantly needing to be, bucked up and told he's wonderful and constantly self-congratulatory, which he is. And then in a snap, in just a finger snap, he can turn and show his paranoid tendencies because all he does is attack people who speak out against him or raise an issue about what he doesn't like or talk about his ineffectiveness. Does that do it for you, Alan?
No, I was interested in what you and how you saw it. I don't see him as paranoid. I see him, on the contrary, as somebody who knows damned well what he's doing. And knows that he's playing to that base. He wants to turn them out. He's going to get them out there one way or another. Paranoia.
I don't think these are naturally opposed to one another. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Nixon was paranoid, and he did everything he needed to do to throw red meat to his base as well. I mean, the Southern strategy is, you know, Trump is following through on Nixon's Southern strategy in a way that no one ever thought possible.
So I think it's also,
Jim Carter, go ahead.
Trump learned early on at the side of Roy Cohn how to employ these tactics. And he's followed that playbook all along through his career, and we can see him doing it in the White House. We can also see that, you know, he is deciding to, you know, not only say that, you know, all these protests are the work of outside provocateurs who are coming in, and that, you know, he's trying to delegitimize the basis of the protests, which is centuries in making, as Alan and Libby have said. And, you know, he's even said that he wants to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization, which he does not have the legal or constitutional right to do. That law is only set up to designate foreign terrorist organizations. But, you know, he's never been one to focus on the details of something trivial like the actual law and the Constitution. So I agree with Alan. He's not paranoid. This is calculated to play to his base and to delegitimize the real issues that are at play here, the legitimate issues that are at play here.
I'm not going to argue whether or not he's paranoid or not. It's not that important. We can all agree that the man is unhinged, and yet in a way that he is consistent in his actions.
We can all agree he's immoral. That's for sure.
That's for sure. And so is Roy Cohn, a blemish on civilized society.
I do want to welcome to the conversation C.G. Dodds. We have not been able to get a hold of. So we made a call to our friend Clarence Taylor, who was with us on Friday. And he is an assistant professor. I'm sorry, Professor Emeritus. My apologies. Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY, and author of Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality. Clarence, thank you very much for being with us again. It's so good to have you back on the program.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Thank you.
So what do you make? We only have about a minute and a half here before we have to take a break, but I'll just bring you in of what do you make of when we were talking on Friday? We obviously have seen this creep not just from Minneapolis, but throughout the United States of how do you
and
see
the world.
These protests right around the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously people who are fed up with this extremely long history of police violence. And, you know, the fact that this officer, Derek Coven, only received third-degree murder charges and that the three other officers were not charged, really got to millions of people in this country and, of course, throughout the world. So, yeah, what we're seeing here is an uprising. But let me also note that you just can't label this as violence on the part of the protesters. There's a lot of police violence that is going on. You know, police attacking journalists, police attacking protesters who are protesting nonviolently. So they're sort of hyping this thing also. And of course, you know, there are loads of nonviolent protests taking place. But, you know, what does the media focus on, right? They constantly keep focusing on the more violent events because I guess they want to draw in clearly more viewers.
Yeah, but is it happening or isn't it? I mean, is it happening or isn't? This is Alan. Do you mean to say that the Tay Market, the wonderful Koreans who run a market down the street, three doors down from WAMC, deserved in some way or shouldn't be paid attention to when their store is destroyed?
No, but I'm also saying that there are a number of nonviolent protests taking place that need to be focused on. Because what you do is walk away with this view that what we see in the street is nothing but violent protest. And that is the problem.
When you look at that through the history of this, Professor Taylor, when you look at this, does this, as I mentioned the subtitle of the book, of the long history of police brutality, it is that, and you write specifically about New York City, but do we always see this level of violence, this level of protest, this level of, I have not used the riot word because I don't think it's appropriate, but I mean, it is certainly has been called rioting, or even, but let's just say confrontation.
Well, yes, we have seen this in the past, where there have been violent confrontation. In 1964, in New York City, after a 15-year-old African American was shot by an off-duty police officer, Harlem erupted, and a few days Bedford-Stuyvesant erupted. And let me note here that, the police went wild in 1964. In one day, they shot so many bullets that they ran out of them and they had to wait for a truck to come in so they could reload. So, yeah, I mean, and also the officials in New York City and also, I should also note, in the Johnson administration blamed agitators. They blamed people on the left for causing the disturbances without really addressing what's at the root of the problem. And that is police assault, police overwhelming power over citizens. And so, you know, we're going to continue seeing this over and over again unless that's addressed.
How do you?
And Joe, could I jump in?
Yes, of course.
On this?
Yes.
I think another, this is Jim, another element that you see now, too, in addition to what Professor Taylor is talking about in the long history of this, is post 9/11 kind of upping the ante in the militarization of our local police forces around the country. After 9/11, we saw that Congress, the president, then George W. Bush, sent tremendous amounts of money for military equipment and training to police forces. And so we see police forces, you know, now turning out. If you looked at a picture of 2020 police on the street in a situation like this versus, that 1964 events, which was terrible too, you know, you really see a military version of the police. You see that, you know, you see it's not to say that, you know, the systemic issues weren't there, but now it's almost kind of on steroids. And in addition to being given a green light from above, as the president himself said, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, oh, don't worry about injuring people when you're making arrests or anything like that. He's been giving these sort of, you know, green lights all along. But this militarization issue is something that I've seen myself in working overseas in many different places, where the military equipment ends up being turned on its own people, on the citizens of the country. And I think that's just another element to this story.
There are so many elements to this story, and I want to. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into many more. We have some letters as well, and we'll bring everybody up to date. We'll take a break. We'll come right back, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok is here, Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at American University, Cairo. Jim Ketterer, political consultant, Libby Post, Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY, and author of Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality, all join us this morning. We welcome your call, whether your letters, your emails, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Clarence, let me ask you a question of something that both Jim and Alan brought up. But when we hear about the president and wanting to put this at the hands of Antifa and to declare this as a terrorist organization, what does that do, and what do we know? I think we're probably all in agreement that there is really little evidence to say that is the case, that these protesters are coming from this organization, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so where do we go with this? What does that add to the equation?
Well, I think it's an opportunity for Donald Trump. He's been sinking in the polls. The coronavirus crisis has displayed his ineptitude and that he has no business being in the White House. But this also presents an opportunity for him at this moment. So he is essentially playing on people's fears. And this is what I meant by, you know, when we constantly watch these images, there are millions of people who are watching this who are frightened by it. I spoke to a friend of mine just this morning who is a liberal, but he says that the looting that's going on in his neighborhood has scared him. And he said he agrees with Trump in that horrible statement he made that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And so that, and Trump is clearly aware of this. And that's why they are saying that this is a left-wing attack. And they are playing it to that sort of politics of fear.
Libby?
Oh, I agree that, well, I think you'll see when the history books are written on this chapter, if we're able to still publish by then, I think you will see that these were outside agitators, not from the left per se. I mean, maybe there were some, but I think more from the right. I've been reading a lot about how the white supremacist groups want to stoke fear and even start a civil war, which is a little far-fetched, but maybe not so much. So I think you're going to see that some of this agitation online, the social media stuff, may have roots back to what's going on in terms of, you know, Russia impacting our social discourse on social media, just ginning all of that up. And that this isn't from the left per se only. I think there's overwhelmingly it's going to be from the right. And I also think that, you're not going to see what people expect that, oh, this is all only the people who are protesting, only the black people were doing this. And we've seen over and over and over again that's simply not true. And to whose advantage is it to destroy black businesses. It's not to the advantage of the African-American community. It is to the advantage of the white supremacist elements in our society. And don't fool ourselves. We should never be fooled to think that we don't have it here in the Capital District or the Great Northeast. I grew up on Long Island. The South Shore was a hotbed for the Klan.
Jim?
And, you know, I just wanted to say, to follow up on what Libby said, these groups on the right, just before the COVID crisis broke, there was a New York Times investigative piece on Eric Prince. You might remember him, of Blackwater infamy, also the brother of Betsy DeVos.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, that he, in his latest incarnation, has been hiring former intelligence agents and others, and they had evidence throughout this story of infiltration of a variety of organizations over the last few years to carry out these kinds of activities. You know, this is a long-standing, long-term plan underway. That makes me sound like a paranoid as well, but this is a great piece that was really overtaken by events with the COVID crisis, so it didn't get the attention that it deserves. But I just went back and read it again this morning, and it's really compelling stuff and important stuff with evidence. Unlike the Antifa charge, this has real evidence.
Well, Professor, Professor, I just wanted to ask Jim a question, if I can. Could you speak to what you expect in the polls, which is something that is greatly concerning me? You know, Donald Trump is down 10 to 11 points in all the major polls before this happened.
Right.
And it is to his great advantage, political advantage, that this is happening. What do you expect of the American people? You know, we did hear that you know, so there are some people out there who have legitimate concerns about these businesses going under, black businesses and other businesses, Korean businesses. Do you expect that the American people will keep up that 10-point advantage for Joe Biden?
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry.
I think to Jim, and then but anybody.
No, go ahead, Professor Taylor. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, you know, as I heard someone say yesterday, 6 months can be an eternity, you know, six months of the election, right? So no, I don't expect that 10 or 11 point lead that Biden has to hold. This situation, of course, always plays into the hands of those who are always pushing law and order and tough tactics. I saw some of Trump's tweets where he is really just upholding what he said over the weekend, you know, and he's encouraging governors to come down hard and get tough with protesters. Right.
Well, let me come back on that for a second, because I think it needs to be explored. The New York Times has, I believe it was the New York Times, I read a lot in the middle of the night, has an article about the Biden lead. And the Biden lead, in every presidential election, Jimmy Carter, where he lost and all the rest, has always been enough to elect a president. So when you say that, you know, it's too early, at least in the Times analysis, it isn't too early based on this tremendous lead he has. And the question is, does Trump make out like a bandit as a result of this? And also, in terms of what Libby said, is this planned in some way?
You know, like I said, these are sort of unique circumstances, right?
Indeed.
So if you can gin up enough fear, I think one can turn that around. Listen, Hillary Clinton had a huge lead also in 2016 over Donald Trump, but she's not the president, right?
Right.
I'll come back on that. I'll come back on that too. But according to the time,
like I said, looking at national polls is important, but you also got to look at these state polls,
yeah, we know
where you know, elections are really decided.
And yet, I want to come back on that because I think this needs to be discussed. The Times piece says specifically that Biden was doing well enough to win in all of those crucial states. So it isn't as if I'm unaware that's important. But again, this would be a tremendous. I'm only asking whether Libby or you or anybody else believes that this is possibly all ginned up.
Libby?
What do you mean, all ginned up just for the presidential election?
Well, no, not just for the presidential election, but as a part of the violent part of this. Look, I'm separating this into two parts. One of them is the very legitimate protest that is going on around the United States over this horrible death. And I saw it one more time. I never realized when they said he has his foot on his neck that he was looking upward with his foot, with the cop's foot on his neck.
And the cop, it was actually his knee, and the cop had his hands in his pocket like it was no big deal. It was a bizarre image.
But Libby, the separation here between peaceful protest, which is so legitimate, and the violence is what's interesting me here. And who sent that play in that we should destroy everything? We should burn, baby.
Well, as a white person who has incredible white privilege, I know that I could have walked down, you know, State Street, nobody was going to bother me. You know, I mean, I know that that's the case. And I understand the rage that is coming from the people of color communities and how violence can become an outlet for that, especially with what's going on. But as Jim talked about, the infiltration, it reminds me what happened during the anti-war movement when Hoover and, you know, the FBI were infiltrating anti-war organizations to turn those violent as well, and to undermine their credibility as well. And so, you know, is violence always something that will happen from this because of people's anger? It just might. But was it going to be as intense and destructive to their own community, to the, you know, to black businesses, to people of color businesses? I don't think so. So I think part of this is ginned up. And then it's just really hard to tell one from the other, and it just feeds on itself because people see other people being angry. They're like, screw this, I'm going to be angry too. And they just act out as well, and it just continues to escalate. And so, you know, then you have what happened here in Albany yesterday morning where people came together of all colors to clean up down on Delaware Avenue, Central Avenue, and Arch Street, and down in the South End, to come together to clean up, to help people rebuild their businesses. And, you know, I'm working with a candidate who represents that district in the Assembly, John McDonald. We talked last night about how we can get money to those folks, and Mayor Sheehan, from what I understand, is going to use the city's Industrial Development Authority, Capitalize Albany, to help reestablish those businesses. I mean, there are things we can do. It's just, it shouldn't have happened in the first place.
A couple of notes. First of all, Mayor Sheehan will be our guest coming up at about 11:10 this morning, so she'll be joining us. Also want to mention there is a special program that is going to be on tonight. It is called America, Are We Ready? A national call-in about racism, violence, and our future together. It is with Brian Lehrer, and we will be airing that from 8 to 10 tonight here on WAMC. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters, so I want to get to those. We'll continue right after this.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here. We also have Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and we have Clarence Taylor with us, Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College at CUNY. Clarence, let me ask you a question, and then we'll go to the letters here. I'm curious of something you were talking about earlier about the concern of the message of the protest being lost because of the violence. How do we keep that more pure in the sense of to keep, because what we keep on hearing about is these very peaceful protests that happen during the day, happen up until about 7, 8 o'clock, then the people go home, and then protests in many parts of the country then turn violent. How do we keep that, the reason for those protests, what we described in such great detail on Friday's program, about to keep that part of the equation center on the radar?
You're talking about how we keep the peaceful protests,
yes,
the center?
Well, the protest itself, but the reason for the protest. I mean, the reason and what is ultimately being protested and the change that is being sought.
Well, yeah, and I think we do that by focusing on the cause of the protest, right? And that is police brutality. We have to focus on ways of dealing with police brutality, and people have to be upfront with this and discuss ways of stopping this. And like I said, yeah, that's sort of lost now. And I think even seeing folks who talk about police and demonstrators coming together, well, that is important, and we should clearly focus on that. But that sort of obscures the problem here. I mean, essentially the solution to the problem, and that problem is, are we really going to address in a very serious way this this ongoing problem, something that we've been talking about for decades? When I was writing my book, and people would always ask me, so what are you working on now? Because I've written a number of books. And I said, well, I'm working on a book on police brutality. And the usual response was, oh, that's timely. And I would say to myself, well, if I was writing this in 1965,
it would still be timely.
Someone would ask me that question, and I would tell them I'm working on a book on police brutality. They would probably have a response, that's timely. Well, because it's ongoing. And I think we need to sort of see that how this has erupted, leading to these outbursts, demonstrations on the streets.
Let me.
I'm sorry. That may be my phone.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
Joe, could I just say one thing too?
Of course.
I think there's so many ways that people's attention can be taken away from, as you say, what are the real goals here? What are the legitimate grievances here? And, the outside agitators, all of that is in many ways a purposeful way to try to distract from these deeper goals. I think also an understanding of the many promises unkept over the centuries of the country, the things that were supposed to be hopeful, like Brown v. Board of Education, which ended up really not addressing the problems that it was supposed to address, and many, many, many others. And that, we can see it's not even just a question. Of course, it's important to prosecute the police who have violated the law, but that's sort of a tactical and immediate issue. What is police brutality innate of? What is it a function of more deeply? And if we don't get at those issues yet again, it's another promise unkept. It's another opportunity lost, and this will continue to happen. And it just seems to be. It's so frustrating because it's so unending in this country.
Well, we have not by the way, that was my phone, so I'm sorry. But we have not done anything to quell the surge of racists, KKK members, white supremacists joining our police forces. I mean, that's been well documented, and we're not doing anything about it. And that, you know, so then you have that, you have someone with those kinds of politics now in power, in what they consider to be their personal power for law and order. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, and let me add to that. I agree with that. But we also have to address policies that have been adopted. You know, we mentioned earlier about the militarization of the police. Well, you know, the police are supposed to be a peace force, right? They're separate from the military. But the lines have been blurred. Right, where we have up the ante of militarizing the police, or are we going to militarize them? Well, how are they usually going to respond to domestic situations? And so, you know, that's one problem. I think these programs that we have adopted, you know, and I mentioned last week, you know, about doing away with things like broken windows policies, which is in, it's not just in New York, it's throughout the country, right? Going after the low-level offenses, criminalizing lots of behavior, and then winding up in these confrontations.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. As promised, we do have a lot of letters, so I really will get to those when we come back. I really will. We'll do that. We'll take a break. We'll get some news. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Clarence Taylor on the program this morning. And as promised, we have letters. We have many. I will get to them. Panel, I'll read them. And if you want to stop me and comment on them, please do. Jerome says, not to distract from the memory of George Floyd, but I have to ask, when a person is handcuffed and face down, where are they going to go? Why is it necessary to place a knee on the person's neck? If anything, it can be placed on the back between the shoulder blades with the same effect. I don't understand why this tactic is still employed after the potential for death with this restraint. Clarence, I mean, we know that is a tactic that should not be used, but certainly has been used in the past and is known to work, right?
Well, it's been known to, work, but I mean, you know, there are other tactics, less violent, less lethal that work. So there is absolutely no reason on earth for that incident.
All I meant by that was that one point it was an accepted form of policing. It no longer is, correct?
Well, no, actually, it is accepted, that tactic. I mean, it's accepted in Minneapolis. That was the problem. The police officer was using a tactic that police were allowed to use. And these are the types of tactics that have to be essentially outlawed.
No, well, maybe
they,
I got this.
Should not be part of that. Their
well, maybe I have this wrong, but I thought I heard the chief suggesting that it was against the rules.
Yeah, I thought that's why they were fired, actually.
Yeah. So I mean, that doesn't ring right to me. At least, if the chief is to be believed, that it is.
I heard differently, so I may be wrong on this.
Okay.
But
and it may be against the rules in Minneapolis. But that doesn't mean it's against the rules in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if in fact what you're saying is that in one specific place it was allowed and it isn't, I accept what you've said that, you know, you may have been wrong. Because at least according to the authorities there, that, as Joe just said, that's why they were kicked off the force. That's why they were immediately fired. All four of them.
I mean, the other thing, too, I guess, is the question that comes up about the question that was asked from the listener was, if you have them in handcuffs, where are they going to go? And I guess that's it, right? You know, so why do you have to go beyond that?
Okay, so there is an answer to that, I suspect, and that is terror. The police want to engage in basically their own terroristic activity, which is, if you mess with us, we're going to kill you. And so that's the answer to the question.
Let us go.
Yeah.
Okay. Let us go to other questions here. Melissa says, I want to comment on the riots and looting. From what I have seen, many police and undercover agents seem to be inciting these riots and fires. They are not part of the protest. They are trying to discredit the movement. We got this one from Louie, who says, Governor Cuomo continues to grow in stature before my eyes. This weekend's violence was so heartbreaking. However, the governor's speech yesterday gave me hope. He continually speaks of we as one people. He refuses to play the us and them politics of division and name-calling. I am very grateful for that. Kathy says, Black Lives Matter now tainted. Now when I hear the slogan Black Lives Matter, I will think of violence, savagery, and chaos during a pandemic crisis, all due to the death of someone that had a criminal background and again placed himself in harm's way. And most of all, I will think of the legacy of Dr. King turning to dust.
Oh, let's just blame the victim, shall we? That's all I have to say.
Yeah, but I think that letter does sort of reflect a certain attitude mm-hmm. in this country. This is a black man with quotes who they see as a criminal, and therefore the police can do no wrong. And what we see with these protests, essentially they are anti-police, and this is the type of sentiment that Donald Trump and others are playing on.
Jim, are you there? Yep. Okay. Mike writes to us and says, hello, panel. Every day I wake up and think things can't get worse, but yet they do. This is what happens when there is a void in leadership at the top. Trump has proven he is not only in over his head, but drowning and taking all of us with him. I pray that Sleepy Joe is our next president and that he chooses a smart woman as VP to help us on the road to recovery.
You know, Joe.
Go ahead.
Please, go ahead. No, you, Jim.
I'm just going to say it has, you know, all of this too on the level of the VP choice has gotten more interesting. Senator Klobuchar and her past activities as Attorney General may, in fact, be disqualifying now for her to be considered as VP.
Hmm.
I think she is. I was watching her this weekend. She was on television defending her decisions as the attorney of the Hennepin County there, where Chauvin had a number of complaints, and she sort of just passed it off to a grand jury, although she's making the argument that she had already been senator. But the reality is, those complaints were made before she became senator, so she could have taken action. And the fact that and the 24 cases of police shootings of black citizens, not one of those cases where she were police convicted. She handed it all off to the grand jury, didn't really take initiative to prosecute those cases. So yeah, I think she's clearly at this moment toxic for Joe Biden.
Well, you never know. Here's the point. You better believe that the Trump people and that the Biden people are polling like crazy to see what the American people think of all of this. And if, in fact, either camp finds, well, certainly we know where Trump's going. But if Biden finds that people are unhappy about the way this whole thing has been exploding, they may take somebody who has a modicum of conservatism in her. I suspect that's a possibility, and he's been indicated.
Well, they can take Val Demings. She's a former police chief from Orlando, a woman of color, well spoken during the impeachment hearings. She would be a great choice.
Will you be making that choice, Libby, or will it be?
I wish I was. Someone should call me.
Well, you are a consultant, for God's sake.
Yeah, I know.
Kamala Harris, right?
Yeah, there you go.
You know, we're getting a number
she
of
She has
letters.
The same issue. She has the same issue as former attorney general.
She does.
Right, but she was just doing her job. That's, you know, I mean,
but
as
politically,
attorney general,
it's still an issue.
Yes, I know. I know.
Yeah.
I know you know better than I do, that's for sure.
You know, we've been getting a number of letters, Joe. I'm sure you're going to get to one or two of them, in which they say violence is justified. It's an acceptable form of protest. You know, it's like the numbers, 100,000 people died from the pandemic. On the other hand, you know, when you get to know that these people have names and that they built their business for a lifetime, and they make pennies on the dollar in order to survive and get by, it's not justified to me.
Christopher writes to us and says, I love listening to everyone, especially Alan, but did you see the two police cars that rammed into a group of protesters? Rammed into the barricade fence and went right through the protesters. That is a form of violence that terrorists use. These officers that are using force to scare protesters into going home are terrorists. They are terrorizing their own citizens, and it's disgusting. The rioters are also terrorists, looting small businesses, and should be prosecuted to the fullest extent. I hope WAMC weathers the storm. Clarence, let's talk a little bit about Mayor de Blasio, who has been having some great criticism over this weekend.
Well, yeah, and this is what my point I made last week, that de Blasio attempts to walk the fence. Here's a guy who ran as a person who was going to reform the New York City Police Department. And at the beginning, he did take some steps that were clearly important, including getting rid of the racial component of stop, question, and frisk policy. But when the police union turned on him, used their political force, their power. And de Blasio saw his numbers and polls dropping among white New Yorkers. He walked back. And ever since then, he has defended the police in any type of these actions, encounters. And so, he's in a bad position. He tries to present himself as a man of the left, but on the other hand, he essentially goes along with making excuses for police officers and that are behaving terribly.
Well, we'll see what happens. His daughter got arrested.
Right.
So we'll see if she gets off really easy or if she goes through the process or spends
she's
in our Rikers.
She's going to get off really easy.
But my focus, and I make this argument in the book, is the enormous amount of power that police have and political power. We cannot overlook the political power that police have. Where they can make folks in power essentially bend them to their will. And that's what's happened to not just de Blasio, but other politicians, other mayors in New York before de Blasio who wouldn't dare challenge police power.
Okay, two questions then. One is... where does the base of that power come from? You wrote the book. And second is, what's the name of the book so everybody can go get it?
Oh, okay. Well, the name of the book is, I'll answer that one first, Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality in New York City. Now, where does the first question you asked, where does that power come from, the political power we're talking about here? Well, it comes from, first of all, a culture that has sort of glorified police. You just turn on your television and watch all the police shows, right?
Right.
I mean, we were inundated with this, and this goes back decades, but in addition to politicians who have used the police to sort of promote their own careers, right? To talk about emphasize law and order, and that we have to support the police to protect us from criminals. And now the police, of course, have gotten the message. And so in New York in 1966, when a liberal Republican mayor, John Lindsay, attempted to introduce a moderate reform measure, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which would consist of four civilians and three police officers to investigate police brutality and to have people use that the Civilian Complaint Review Board as a way of people being able to express their grievances. But in the end, essentially, it was the police commissioner and the police force that would decide the outcome of any type of complaint that was found legitimate. The police union, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, went berserk. They led a campaign once the Civilian Complaint Review Board was created. They led a campaign to essentially dismantle it. And they used the most racist, measures to undermine it, noting that if you allow this Civilian Complaint Review Board to exist, what you're going to do is tie the hands of the police. And in even one ad, they showed a white woman walking out of a subway station at night and saying that we can't protect her unless we get rid of the Civilian Complaint Review Board. And they managed to get a referendum on the ballot, and New Yorkers voted that Civilian Complaint Review Board down 3-1. overwhelmingly white New Yorkers were against it and voted it down, whereas black and Latino voters voted for it. So it divided the city on racial lines. But the police realized at that moment, hey, we have a lot of political power here, that we can use this narrative of essentially saying anytime they attempt to go after us or try to curtail our power, we will come out and let them know that, you know, by doing that, you are essentially hurting the police and therefore essentially not protecting white citizens. And so it's that narrative that the police have used, and they used it against de Blasio, and that's why de Blasio backed away.
Let's go back to some letters. I have one from Brendan that I just think is a great letter. Agreeing with so much of what you are saying, and I think this is all quite complex, what do you all think about the wall-to-wall coronavirus coverage going away almost entirely for wall-to-wall protest coverage? People on the right think the whole thing is staged by the media as a way to divide people before an election. Can you discuss the responsibilities and role in the media, roles of the media, in balancing clear information and sensationalizing everything, COVID included, for viewers' attention?
There's another way to look at that, which is, I don't think this is a media plot. I think this may be a Trump plot. You know, I mean, obviously, he was really on the ropes from the COVID thing. Everybody fairly well agreed that he was responsible for the way in which it was rolled out in the first place, and that there were tens of thousands of deaths because of him, and he wasn't getting away from that. And all of a sudden, we get this. So I don't know that it's a media plot. I think this plays right into Trump's hands.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it is essentially a media plot, but I think the media has really sort of sensationalized this, and you know, you do it for ratings, right?
What would you do? Would you not show the burning buildings? Would you not?
No, we live in a 24/7 news cycle now.
Yeah. Right.
So there has to be something to constantly fill the airwaves,
you know?
And so you're always going to have these images. You're always going to, I mean, we watched CNN last night for a little while, and it was like from one city to the next city to the next city.
Right.
You know, that it's just the product of the news cycle and where we are. And so I don't know if it's sensationalizing it as much as it is the media trying to get the facts out to people in a time when facts don't matter to the cowards sitting in the White House.
I don't know.
Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, just one perhaps quaint thought that, you know, the only antidote to whatever one blames the media for, or online trolls, or any fake news, any of this, is that people need to engage in critical thinking. They need to approach everything with a healthy dose of skepticism. They need to read and listen to and watch things from a variety of sources. You know, it's without that, again, crazy idea, without an informed and engaged citizenry, the rest of it all just falls apart.
Yeah. And I would also add, when you raise the question, you know, what else would you focus on? Well, I mean, there's a lot of things happening in the world. Well, but they decide not to focus on events that are taking place overseas, and instead constantly focus on events here in the United States. You know, I watch MSNBC sometimes, and in the morning, and I said this is just essentially Trump. I know they refer to Fox News as Trump News, but MSNBC, that's all they cover. And there are other things taking place in the world that we and Americans have like no idea about these.
Well, you know,
events.
Well, you know, Professor, if you were, a news director, and your job depended on the numbers of people who were watching, you would probably. I'm not taking their side, and I'm not saying you're not right, but I am saying you would probably make the same decisions they are, or you wouldn't have a job.
Yeah. Well, I would do something else, I guess.
Well, you know, and I have to say, I mean, I think for those of us, I mean, on Saturday night, I wanted to listen to WAMC because I wanted to, and Sunday, I wanted to find out what was going on here in Albany. And I just think that's natural. I mean, I don't know that that's you want to know what the impact is on your community. Is that sensationalizing it? I don't think so. I mean, if there are hundreds or a thousand people out and that is happening in our community, I don't know how you do not report that.
Yeah, no, I don't say you don't report it. I mean, obviously you have to report it. But, you know, I think there has to be some balance.
I understand. I understand that that's much different from wall-to-wall 24-hour news coverage.
Right.
Where you're rehashing it over and over and over again. I certainly do understand that.
Well, but Joe, we have seen so many times, I don't know about anybody else on this panel, but when I turn on CNN or MSNBC or Fox, and I find a sort of forced recitation of what's going on, and there's nothing going on.
Well, and there's nothing new, and they're using quotes from 3 days ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, but they need to fill up their space.
Right, and they always call it breaking news.
Yes, exactly, Clarence. Right. Yes, you know, it's always breaking news.
But if you want, you know, when we talk about sensationalism, when you look at print, you look at the difference between the New York Post and the New York Daily News, who the news I happen to like now, their front pages as tabloids versus the New York Times, the Washington Post. You know, there's just a difference in the tenor of how they present the news,
but
it's to sell.
But Libby, there's a rationale for that. I think the Daily News has correctly decided that we want to represent people of color in New York City.
Absolutely,
and that's why you like it. On the other hand, the New York Post has no such agenda.
No.
And it's a business agenda. That's what it is. It's not a moral agenda. It's a business agenda.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have we just have a minute, so I'll just get to like two or three more letters, and we'll go. There is so much video of what is going on. The powers that be should sit down with representatives of Black Lives Matter and ACLU and find the police that are abusing power and fire them and or arrest them, and promote officers that de-escalate and work positively with protesters. That would be a great litmus test. In regards to the letter that mentioned savagery, you are incredibly misinformed. You need to do more research on MLK. George Floyd did not put himself in harm's way. He was targeted and murdered, even if he was really using a forged bill. That is not an offense that warrants death. Yeah. Your words shocked me. That from Lily. We're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation last round with our panel. We'll include your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our final go-round here on the program. We just have a couple of announcements. One is that Governor Cuomo is expected to be speaking this morning at 11:30. He'll be speaking from New York City, and we'll be talking about the state's response to coronavirus, as well as, of course, the protests in the city and state. So we will be hearing that live coming up as soon as it becomes available, shortly after 11:30 this morning. Also, there is a special program that will be airing tonight. It is called America, Are We Ready? With Brian Lehrer. It is a two-hour program that is a national call-in to have a conversation about racism as well as the election. And it will be on tonight at 8, from 8 to 10, America, Are We Ready? With Brian Lehrer. That coming up tonight. All right. Let me go to a lot of letters. And we go to Anne, who says, why the insistence on referring to property destruction as violence as if it were an unjustified reaction to murder? Slavery did not start in this country directly because of racism, but because it was profitable. The destruction of capitalist symbols makes sense as a reaction to the racism and hatred ingrained by the current capitalist system. The destruction of police vehicles makes sense as a tactic to limit the mobility of an oppressive power.
And the breaking of the windows and the closing of a wonderful Korean family that is trying to get by on a dime on a dollar or whatever it is justified as a tactic. I can see your argument about the police car, although I don't like it. But I can tell you now that this business about attacking your own businesses in your own neighborhood, that doesn't make sense.
Alan, there are some people who just want to burn down the house and think that we need to start over. And that's where this is coming from.
And when that happens, I'm going to tell you what you're going to get, Donald Trump.
Well, you know, I always used to tell my brother, when the revolution comes, call me, I'm going to go out for lunch. So, you know, it's not very likely, but I think that in the long-term effects, what you're saying is probably true. Not only would we get Donald Trump, we would get an authoritarian dictatorship, because that's what always happens.
Jorah writes and says,
indeed,
by nature of the fact that people are objecting to an oppressive system, there is no wrong way to protest. Of course, nobody wants to have their store looted. But bringing up this temporary repairable destruction or the fact that you no longer get to go shopping there is irrelevant. There is something to be said for protest that brings the brutality and inequalities of our law enforcement and criminal justice system to light and into mainstream media when decades and decades of peaceful protests have failed to change anything. Please keep the focus on the violence, oppression, brutality, and murder faced by Black Americans. That's what the issue is.
Well, I do not agree. I don't think that if you take somebody's property away from them who've worked hard to make a life in America, that it is justified. You know, what happens when somebody burns down your house? You're going to say, okay, that's okay, because it's for a greater cause. You know you won't, and I tell you right now, I don't like it.
We also got this letter from Nick, who says there's good reason to believe that a lot of this violence is being perpetrated by white supremacists and neo-fascists. For instance, it's been reported that a large number of those arrested in Minneapolis are white, the majority, and many are from out of state. Also, chatter monitored on the internet indicates that white supremacists discuss provoking violence strategically in just this kind of situation in an effort to push America to the right. Alan is right. The violence only helps Trump. It is largely designed to help Trump. Some of the violence is organic. Most is premeditated. Let's see. Kisty says, I saw this over the weekend, and it really helped me understand what I was struggling with concerning the protest and wanted to share it from the Hampton Institute. You can't commodify every single aspect of living and then not understand looting as a legitimate form of protest. Looting is the ultimate strike against a system that deems mass-produced objects to be far more precious than life itself. It is humanity demanding to be recognized. John says, I'm white and gay, and I have had a different response to the violence. This month marks the anniversary of 50 years of peaceful gay rights protest, which were made possible by the Stonewall riots the year before. Because, you see, there had been peaceful, polite protests for gay rights for several years before Stonewall, all ignored. It took the rage of 4 days to finally get attention. The violence breaking out during the primarily peaceful protests by African Americans the past week. Well, my fellow whiteies, but this is what we get for ignoring the problem for decades. And to anyone who thinks I'm approving of violence, please go to your room and play with your toys. The grown-ups are trying to have a conversation. Libby, anything on that?
Well, just that, yes, June is Pride Month, and Pride did start in a riot. There's no two ways about it. At Stonewall Inn at the end of June, the last Sunday in June, when Judy Garland died. And, you know, yes, that was 1969. It was a different time. We are now in 2020, and we have to recognize that with our 24/7 news cycle, with the internet, with social media, our actions, whether they be peaceful or violent, can be reinterpreted to other people's perspectives and use. So we just have to be mindful of that.
We got this letter from Marcia. It said, thank you for all of the great work. I am a black mother with two black sons, and I am angry, hurt, and exhausted of what has been happening to black and brown men and women in this country. We know change takes time, but how much longer do we have to wait? How much more pain and loss do we black mothers have to endure for racial and social justice for our children and all that have been murdered in the hands of racist police? It has been more than 400 years, and the unjustifiable killings of black men and women has not ended. My heart is broken. I feel powerless and helpless because no matter how I love, educate, and nurture my black sons, I cannot keep them safe from police brutality and our racist society. My family and I participated in a peaceful protest in New Paltz on Saturday, but that is not enough. We have to keep the struggle and keep the pressure until we bring about real, much-needed reform in our institutions. I am terrified for the safety of my sons, who are 14 and 12 years old, and I fear for every black and brown child in this country. Change has to happen now. We cannot wait any longer. This is a black mother's heart and soul outcry.
I love that letter. I love the letter.
Very powerful.
I love that letter, and I agree with every word of it. I got to say that, you know, I keep invoking my grandson, who is African-American. I just know that everybody who understands what this is all about understands that a kid walking out on the street can get really hurt, or riding a bicycle or jogging, because of the skin, the pigmentation in his skin. It's that simple. I love that letter.
Clarence?
Yes, I think it's a powerful letter. You know, I'm just sort of thinking about this conversation in terms of the use of violence. And I think, you know, I would like to sort of take it in another direction. I mean, that is an emotional response, right? We have this eruption. And of course, you have people who are manipulating it for their own political purposes. But I think it's important. I mean, this can be a moment where people can think about real solutions to the problem and bring pressure on those in power to push for those solutions, or at least, you know, also put their effort into electing people who are really dedicated to those solutions. Because I agree that, you know, burning down someone's store where they worked hard to build is not a very good solution. I don't even think setting police cars on fire is going to a real, you know, one can understand the reaction. But, you know, I think it also plays into the hands of those forces that are pushing for tougher measures on protesters. So I think what we really have to do is, okay, we got a moment here. We can now think about real solutions to this problem and focus on the problem and not just focus on just the violence.
And could I just say the letter writer mentions overall reform of our institutions, plural. That, yes, the immediate issue and longstanding issue is police brutality, but it's beyond that. It's our many institutions across the wide array of society, and we need to take a long and hard look at all of them and to see how they need to be reformed as a response to these legitimate grievances.
To which I say bravo. That's exactly right. We have a racist society, period. It is. There's no question about it. And the police are, you know, the front guard for all of this. Nevertheless, it goes far further than the police.
That's right. And then, you know, we got to look at the growing economic disparity in this country, where people are, you know, just don't have money. You know, you talk about folks who don't have $400 in their savings accounts, right? People who are unemployed, people who don't have health insurance. So, yeah, those are, you know, long-term systemic problems that have to be addressed.
And now we have the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien. He was asked yesterday about systemic racism, and I don't think there's systemic racism in the police departments. How tone deaf can you be? Just given everything that's going on around you, and this is an example of the blinders that Republicans have on regarding this president and what's going on in this country.
Well, it's also a political strategy, too.
which is the blinders, yes, I agree. Yeah.
We are out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank everybody who... I know, it is sad, isn't it? But don't worry, we'll be back, and everything will be fine. We'll talk again, I promise you. Like tomorrow, actually. My thanks to, of course, Libby and Jim. Thank you very much. Clarence Taylor, thank you for being here again. I so appreciate you taking the time, and certainly at the last minute. The book is Fight the Power, African Americans... and the Long History of Police Brutality, Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY. Thank you all very much for being with us. We will continue our conversation. Obviously, we'll have much more on all of this throughout the morning and the governor coming up at 11:30. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.